Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Andre Rodatis, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys. You are all
hey,
here.
Hey, good morning, Paula.
Hi, you guys.
Hello.
Nice to hear you all.
Hello. Yes.
Yeah.
Nice to hear you, too. We're blessed, aren't we? We get to come together on Saturday morning and talk about the most amazing things. I do,
yeah,
you know,
treat.
Pinch me. Yeah, what a treat. We get to talk about angels, seraphim, otherwise known as seraphim in the Urantiable, and angels. It's interchangeable, I think, somewhat anyway. And we're in paper 38. Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe, which, by the way, if you've never read the Urantia book, to our friends who may be listening that are curious about it, that's in part two of the book, which it has four parts, the central and super universes as part one. That's all about the biggest part of creation. And then it gets a little smaller and tells us about the local universe, our universe home. We're one of many. And very many, actually. And then it gets even smaller and tells us about the history of our own world, which it calls Urantia. The book calls our world Urantia. And then it puts icing on the cake by telling us the life and teachings of Jesus, which, in my opinion, if ever there was an ambassador from the heavenly realms, it's him. But he's so much more than that. Anyway, our world was touched in a very personal way by the creator of this universe. And we're about to celebrate that as the world celebrates things. One of the things that the world likes to celebrate is the fact of Jesus. And I'm delighted to celebrate that fact with the world. It thrills me every year.
Whenever they choose to do it, right?
Yeah. You know, because whenever they choose to do it, I'm with them. I want to be a part of that.
Right.
So, happy birthday, Jesus. I got to tell you guys, something that my granddaughter shared with me not long ago, just recently. We were talking about if we ever had, you know, Jesus dreams. Ella said, yeah, I had a Jesus dream when I was young. And I dreamed that I was at your house, Grandma, and I was in the family room where we always, you know, have the Christmas tree. And she said, I woke up and Jesus was putting presents under the tree. And I said to him, Jesus, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm putting presents under the tree. It's my birthday, you know.
Oh, my God. That's great.
So that struck me as so funny because that's the Jesus
makes,
I know.
Makes perfect sense, though.
Yeah, that's. I'm going to give you presents on my birthday because, you know, I'm Jesus. It's my birthday, you know? So anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Glenn said he had one when he was young, and he thinks that it was at a pivotal time because he was only like 6 years old, and Jesus came down through the clouds into his house and closed the clouds behind him.
Wow.
That was another one that kind of tickled me for some reason anyway. I like thinking about our master having a sense of humor. So.
Mm.
He closed the clouds behind him.
Nice. That was a polite thing to do.
Yeah, there was a lesson in that for a six-year-old boy. Anyway.
Don't leave the door open.
Yeah, don't leave the door open. Well, blessed well, Christmas anyway, spirit to all of you guys.
Kind of archetypal. I mean, all those images, you know, the giving of gifts, that God is giving us gifts, and this is a time to celebrate giving gifts to each other and receiving the gifts that God's given us, and then the the archetype of the heavens opening up and giving us a gift, and then Jesus rising again and the heavens reclosing. And in a sense, the revelation is a similar archetype. I mean, it's a gift from above, this fifth epical revelation. Pretty amazing. Yeah.
The gift that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah.
It just keeps on giving.
Mm. Well, you're calling your review of the sort of the architecture of the Urantia book there. That was very helpful. Thank you for that. It kind of reminded me that a lot of what the Urantia book does is remind us of things that have been known on this planet at different times. And I think that could be said of the angels. I mean, we still have a kind of a dwindling understanding of angels from various scriptures from long ago. But the idea, I don't think it's taken seriously by most, you know, modern, particularly secularist folks. So to have the gift in the Urantia book of a renewal of our understanding of the seraphim, the angels, and what that they're actually with us and what they're doing, and all this wonderful detail about what they look after, you know, their purpose in being on this planet is certainly, to me, has been a wonderful gift. I mean, the Urantia book right away opens up the notion of unseen friends, right? We're not alone on this planet. But the detail that it brings to that is so, I find, so very helpful. And the angels are a huge part of that. So I'm glad we're reading this material. It's much needed, this understanding is much, it's sort of like our understanding of the afterlife. That's also been largely forgotten. So,
yeah, I agree. You know, I appreciate that. I've introduced the Urantia book to a lot of people just on the, you know, cold, standing at a booth. So you got two minutes to tell me what this thing's about.
Yeah,
you know, but I always tell people, you know, if you start at the beginning, just know that it's very deep and complex. And if you start with the foreword, just know that it's not indicative of how the rest of the book reads. It's highly condensed, and it's like a crash course in a glossary of terminology, defining things in a way that you never heard before. So, and I love that quote from the book, although I would never discourage anybody from reading the Jesus Papers if that's all they were inclined to read. Quote from paper 19:1-5, it says, "For example, the human mind would ordinarily crave to approach the cosmic philosophy portrayed in these revelations by proceeding from the simple and the finite to the complex and the infinite, from human origins to divine destinies. But that path does not lead to spiritual wisdom. Such a procedure is the easiest path to a certain form of genetic knowledge, but at best it can only reveal man's origin. It reveals little or nothing about his divine destiny." So that's a great argument to at least once in your life read the whole book from cover to cover, right? I mean, that's the way they designed it, to take us on a journey.
Uh-huh. Well, just
you,
that
you've
idea
opened
that
me
have
up
a,
to giving my plug the one-time sequential reading of the Urantia book is the Hajj for
it's
our
Hajj.
Pilgrimage for Urantia book readers.
You're right.
Yeah.
That's true.
I think everybody should do that once in their lifetime, and the sooner the better, but even if it's later, it's the best way to allow the author's sequencing to make its mark on your mind.
Yeah.
They did it for a reason. They indicate
right.
there in that quote, astutely, you pointed out, that they did put things in order for a reason. What people generally, what dissuades them is they say, well, you know, I have such trouble understanding the foreword, and it's so complicated early on. And the way I put it to people, just consider it's an upload. All you're doing is you're going through, you're literally reading it. You are reading it in. You're giving your thought adjuster something to work with. And he doesn't work on your conscious level. It doesn't matter whether you're conscious of it. He gets it, and he'll move with it in the superconscious realms and give good account of what he's done with that later. And those of us that have done a sequential reading, I think, can attest to that. There's something about the quality of what you understand about revelation from having done a sequential reading that you don't get until you've done that. And I'm not saying you have to do that over and over again. You know, I'll give a shout out to my friend J.J. Johnson. We all know him. Wonderful guy. He's read it from cover to cover 33 times. He may be on his 34th time or more. And there are others, you know. And there's something to be said for that too. But it's, in my view, it's that pilgrimage really only needs to be done once.
Well, yeah. And one of the things you discover, at least that I discovered, is that even in the most complex papers, you know, like, I don't know, Supreme and Ultimate, or, you know, the Universal Unity, or even the Foreword, there are nuggets in there that are quite easily understood and very valuable. And drop those in to kind of keep it going. Yeah, you're reading all this stuff, you're just shaking your head. What the heck are they talking about? And then they'll throw in one of those nuggets. And you go, oh, I'm sure glad I read this paper. So,
yeah, you would have missed that.
What's
you would
that?
Have missed
yeah,
that if
right,
you hadn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we discover that every time. I mean, every time we go to read together, you know, we find these things that just seem like, wow, huh. Wonder where
yeah.
they put that in right there. That's pretty cool.
It's like a little reward for your effort.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
exactly.
Yeah, I totally agree, Andre, with what you're saying. I think that's so important. You know, just to move it through your mind, just to read it.
Yeah.
Just conceptually, just move those ideas through your mind, taking whatever you can from it. It creates new precedents, you know, and it's challenging, clearly, but in a positive way. You know, you're feeling, well, I'll come back and look at this again. I'll read it now and come back and look at it again. Maybe I'll understand it better the next time. And that's often the case. I think we've all experienced that. Things that were seemed like beyond comprehension at the first go around, after, you know, maybe reading the whole book and getting a picture or a better grasp of the whole frame of reality that's presented, you can go back to some of that material and it begins to make more sense. You can see it in context, and then it's like has a powerful comprehension or coherence. It brings coherence to the overall message of the book in new and sometimes astounding ways. So,
it is, and you know, when you read it again, you begin to realize what a powerful impact it's had on you. Mm-hmm. Over the years, Dave Tucker was on Facebook the other day, and he was saying, well, I've underlined this paper, you know, so much of this paper 16, it's really a gem. If you haven't visited it recently, you should visit it again. And he took a picture of his book open to paper 16 with all these underlines. I said, I really realized that if I was going to underline, I'd end up underlining the whole book. And so I stopped underlining, but I wish that I had kept going with it, except that I wish that I had dated in the margin when I underlined that. Mm-hmm. Because then I would be able to go back and say, wow, when I was 22, this really jumped out at me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be able to see, you know, over the years, which passages jumped out and when. And then even further, you know, kind of speculate as to why maybe that was and what was going on with me at that time, at that age.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do that. I wish I had. I wish I had just stopped underlining the book but started the practice of dating when I underlined those things.
I could have been insightful, I think. By what I
well, you know, we're
whether it was a Martin pen or a pencil or which color.
Oh, okay, you got a sense of that.
Kind of dated that. Anyway, sorry,
yeah.
Martin.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about the angels, and I actually think that the angels, one of the things the angels do for us, our guardian angels and others, are to help us with things like that, so that we can, in the higher realms, recapture any experience that had spiritual value down here, that our minds, which are so feeble in some sense compared to the angelic minds, they work to supplement and complement us. And I think a lot of that perspective, Paula, that you were talking about, well, how did this experience unfold for me over my lifetime? I think the angels are actually holding a lot of that information, and we'll come back
good
and gift
point.
Us with it. Yeah. And we'll get to interact with them on it.
You know, I love to think of them as our cosmic parents, and it's kind of true. Don't your parents used to do that for you too? I mean, they'd say, gosh, when you were two, you did blah, blah, blah. You know, you don't remember what you did when you were two, but your parents did, you know? So it's interesting they play that role of remembering little you.
I actually think of them as elder sisters. You know, I never thought of them, it just now occurred to me as elders, but they're our sisters. And so when I think about the spiritual family, I really love to think about the angels as our sisters. As we move through the regime.
Elder sisters often play the role of parent, you know. I mean, I just get that they're nurturing us and guarding us. They're doing a lot of the things that our parents did for us as helpless babes. The angels will do for us as helpless maranchins. Maybe not helpless, but, you know.
Or helpless mortals.
Yeah, exactly. Helpless mortals.
Yeah, I
good
mean,
point.
We're...
Yeah.
There, and that can vary in terms of, you know, different junctures of life. Obviously, end of life. There are all kinds of things that in the inner life we may not be helpless, but we start becoming helpless in the outer life. And there are junctures in life as well that become difficult. You know, there can be traumatic losses. There can be any number of things that occur in one's life, and that too is a juncture through which the angels are helping us navigate. You know, I find I get, you know, these days, you know, in
the isolation, which has largely been reinforced by the pandemic, that has, yes, subsided, but the cultural implications of it have not subsided. There, most people I know are still, you know, more isolated than they used to be. There are fewer social gatherings.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
That's true.
It's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that my angels have somebody reach out to me out of the blue, or I will reach out to somebody. And it just underscores for me how important it is that I think through some of those things and remain of service that way. I find other ways to be of service, but that's an important one. It's really wonderful to just out of the blue hear from a friend or someone you haven't heard of for a long time, or even hear from somebody new, as I did. You know, goodness gracious, I got a, you know, Facebook messenger from Chile the other day from a Urantian, and that was fun. Yeah. So you just never know. We've got a wonderful movement, and we need to focus on the fellowship. It really does provide a lot. And I will paraphrase Saskia Rivuri. You know, for those that don't understand the value of being in fellowship, she said, you know, the fellowship may not have done much. Speaking of the Urantian Book Fellowship, one time, the Urantian Brotherhood, which is debatable. I'm not going to quibble about that. But she said, you know what? The people that have come out of the fellowship have done a lot, which was really instructive to me. You know what?
Yes,
there is something that happens as a result of being in fellowship with each other that really helps to kindle the service. And if you don't think the angels are working through that environment, then you're not paying attention, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, your comment,
watch
Andre, made me think of something.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Magic happens. When people come together, magic happens. One of the things that what you just said made me think of Tony Robbins, Anthony Robbins, great self-development guru. He says, what modern men and women need most is to learn to ask a better question. And I wish that, you know, sometimes we ask, well, why did this happen? You know, if something's uncomfortable and it creates a situation that's terrible or seemingly terrible, we say, well, why is this happening? Who did this? Who's to blame for this? You know, we ask all of these questions, you know, why is this happening to me? That kind of thing. But it seems like after a pandemic, which is major kind of a happening, no matter what we believe about it, it affected all of us in one way or the other. And it's good, I think, to reflect on what you learned from that instead of why did this happen, blah, blah, blah. What did we learn from this? And I think one thing that there are several things that I could point to that I learned from it, but one is how precious human contact is. And how, you know, easily we could take that for granted when we can't gather with the people we love, how vital it is to be with the people we love, to be in their presence, not just to see them on a screen or hear their voice, but to have the full dimensional experience of just being in their presence, even if you say nothing. The beauty of a hug. Oh, hugs are so healing and wonderful, right? And the other thing that I noticed is oftentimes, and another good thing that came from it was that I saw was it forced families back into the nuclear cocoon together where they all had to be together, whether mom and dad were working or whatever, and the little children were there and the family was all together. And I, being the person that I am, I love to observe people. I'm a people watcher, and I'm into social interaction, and I always am watching people. And to see them out in the park together, you know, it's like another thing that was so wonderful to me was to just go out walking in the fresh air. It's like, wow, this is great. I can get out and walk, and I don't have to worry about anything. I can just breathe deeply, breathe the fresh air. and the blue sky. And, you know, of course, we live in Colorado, so it's so beautiful here. But, you know, it was great while out walking to see families out in the park playing together, walking together. Children just seemed so happy to me to be with their mom and dad. It's like this thing, you don't see this very often. And I hope that for those young families, it made that point that, yeah, we need to do this even when there's not, you know, something mandating us to not go out to the mall, right? We need to just get out in the park and have fun and play together. That really did my heart good. So, you know, it would be a nice exercise to just write down things I learned from the pandemic while they're still fresh in our minds, you know.
Yeah. Well, Andre, I totally agree. Andre, your comments about things that happen to us, you know, in this life and how the angels minister to us through those things. There's also the mistakes that we make. There's bad outcomes that we
Well, that would be the bigger picture, right? Yeah.
So
many of the things that happen to us, we have a hand in. Yeah, I agree.
Right.
Errors of omission, too.
Right. I'd love to just reread this short paragraph from section two that we read last time in that regard, where they say that angels are, this is the fourth paragraph in section two, where they say, and this brings me great comfort, angels are superior to you in spiritual status, but they are not your judges or accusers. No matter what your faults, the angels, although greater in power and might, bring no accusation against you. Angels do not sit in judgment on mankind, and neither should individual mortals prejudge their fellow creatures. But that the positive quality of their love, I guess, maybe is what I'm kind of taking from that. You know, they're not making a list and checking it twice and going to run off to somebody. I don't know. They understand.
At some point, you know, you have to understand everything that they have seen already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what Marvin was alluding to earlier is, you know, I think of them as my elder sisters. Well, you know, maybe my sisters would. Well, no, it's fair to say elder. By the time they are our seraphim, you know, I doubt that they are younger than millions of years old. You know, they first of all go through a millennium, and by that they mean 5,000 years, Urantia years, of observation. Okay, on Salvington. Then they go through another millennium, you know, in the school to the Seraphim and the Melchizedek University. That's already 10,000 years. That's 10,000 years long before they're ever commissioned. Then they go to the constellation to observe. For how long? They don't tell us. But you can't imagine that it is a short period of time, a short stint. They essentially focus more and more on a local region, unlike thought adjusters, which tend to cross-pollinate their experience through their indwellings. Serially, the seraphim tend to narrow their focus to particular areas, you know, and eventually a local system. Well, by the time they get there, they probably have been observing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, and serving in those realms and serving in a manner that has nothing to do with guardian seraphim work, because they say that's the highest privilege. It's only the seasoned seraphim that get that. Well, that means that our sisters, our spiritual sisters lovingly taking care of us, are probably much, much older than we can imagine. And I don't mean older to bring up any kind of, you know, vision of grandma, because obviously they don't age, you know, corporeally, you know.
Right.
but they do grow in wisdom. And so in terms of thinking of them as, you know, the archetypical wise woman, that is one way of getting our minds around aspects of what seraphic nature is really like. They are wisdom personified in that way, and yet in a corporeal form that would we see them, we would probably think of them as our peers. Because they would not appear to be aged, yeah.
And they're not without a sense of humor, too. I think that's important to remember.
They have to have that.
They better not be if they're dealing with me. Yeah.
I think we probably keep them in stitches, but, you know, to your point, Andre, when I try to see our world through their eyes, then what I see is their knowledge of our continuous progress, however slow, however much slower than it is on a normal world still. If we could see what they've seen here in 10,000 years, we would be so gratified by the progress we've made. I mean, we're so much kinder to each other than we used to be, you know. And we've come a long way on this planet. We've come a long way in the last 50 years. I'm as I look back over my own life, I think, wow, we've done some important things. You know, other things we have missed maybe, but we did contribute some very important things in women's rights and children's rights and, you know, human rights, human goodness and kindness and, you know, using science to help feed the world. You know, we may have made errors along the way because we don't have good foresight. We don't have long foresight, Leslie. We can't see the consequences of this latest, greatest thing 20 years down the road, you know, how it might come back around and bite us. But still, we've made wonderful progress, I think. And that's what I get from them when I try to contemplate what it is they see when they look at us. It's not as dire as it seems. When we look at it the way it is.
And when they do see us, at least as individuals, you know, making mistakes, as we're inevitably going to do, it's like their interest is not in punishing us or whatever. It's about helping us to pick ourselves up and keep going, you know, and learn from those experiences. So there's this sense of always reaching for a positive outcome. And sometimes our mistakes are our greatest teachers, you know, and I'm sure we've all experienced that. And I give a lot of credit to the angels in terms of, well, speaking personally, you know, just helping me to see the value in that experience, even though it maybe didn't turn out so well, but it was instructive. And yeah, okay, I see what happened there. Now I can, you know, recalibrate, adjust, or rededicate myself in some way that will grow from even a negative experience. So I think I tend to think that they're like that, you know. And again, with love and a sense of humor, it's like everything else.
Wisdom,
go along
as
with
Andre
that
said.
kind of forgiving ministry.
Just keep us
going. Don't get discouraged. Don't get depressed. You know, just pick yourself up. Keep going. It's going to be all right. You know, that kind
it's
of
still a beautiful
attitude.
World. Still
yeah,
so much
yeah,
that's
yeah.
beautiful in it. And so
and
many
and in ourselves,
great.
Too.
Yeah.
And in
well,
ourselves
I think that may,
also, which we can sometimes forget.
Yeah.
Yeah, that may come from the, like Andre was saying, the length of their perspective. I mean, they've been, they've seen so much, you know, that they can help us put both our successes and our difficulties, our disappointments into context. And I think they say as much, you know, they really help us put it in context. You know, the other thought that occurred to me while you were all sharing was that these angels have this incredibly long set of experiences before they They get to volunteer and participate as our guardians. And then at that point, if we survive, they change status, that they've been descending orders for their entire spiritual career, coming down and serving and sharing what they know from a larger perspective. And then they shift directions really quite dramatically and begin with us to ascend, you know, and learn what it's like to struggle with us and to move forward and to keep encouraging us. So, I mean, that's really an interesting juncture for the Guardian Seraphim, is to make that switch.
Oh, wow.
From descending to ascending, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to read more about that, but we actually have a kind of almost like a partnership with them, you know, to get to paradise. Mm-hmm. It's like they are our ticket and we are their ticket, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, we work together on our ascension.
And they help
idea.
Us all along the way
right.
in so many ways. I mean, mm-hmm. that makes me think of this, you know, the amazing paper 48 that tells us all about the next life. And and here's just a little bit of what the angels do, and this is like probably one of my favorite two paragraphs. There's two paragraphs together that are just extraordinary. It's paper 48, 635 and 36. From them you will learn to let pressure develop stability and certainty, to be faithful and earnest and withal cheerful, to accept challenges without complaint, and to face difficulties and uncertainties without fear. They will ask, if you fail, will you rise indomitably to try anew? If you succeed, will you maintain a well-balanced poise, a stabilized and spiritualized attitude throughout every effort in the long struggle to break the fetters of material inertia, to attain the freedom of spirit existence? Even as mortals, so have these angels been father to many disappointments. And they will point out that sometimes your most disappointing disappointments have become your greatest blessings. Sometimes the planting of a seed necessitates its death, the death of your fondest hopes, before it can be reborn to bear the fruits of new life and new opportunity. And from them, you will learn to suffer less through sorrow and disappointment. First, by making fewer personal plans concerning other personalities, and then by accepting your lot when you have faithfully performed your duty. I just love that. It's like such a, it just puts in such a nice little capsule some of the basic things that they want to teach us, that they want us to know. And they want us to learn these things here, you know. This is the great opportunity. And going forward, there's nothing to stop us from learning these things here if we can. And that, I think it shows what they're working on, what they're trying to help us do. Beautiful beings that they are. Hard not to get choked up when you're contemplating them, you know? And they're just their amazing and wonderful service to us.
Hmm.
In my immaturity, indeed. Sometimes I wish they wouldn't try quite so hard to let pressure develop stability and certainty. But I know it's all for the good.
Well, I think they're speaking of the higher up experiences as well. You know, that those elements to reality, those experiences we go through, sort of continue all the way along and help us to grow a hardy character, a hardy soul, as we progress. Because I think that section you read was, if I remember correctly, it's the ministering reserves.
Yes,
which,
it is. Exactly.
Yeah, which are working with us as we move through the local universe.
Right.
So it says that when
they're not assigned, they love to be of service and they volunteer, even when not assigned. I love that. Those ministering reserves. And here they are teaching us these valuable lessons. Even though they're not assigned right now, they still have so much to give.
I'm not
assigned right now.
Starting the reading, since we're
okay.
we've had, one-third of the program now for discussion. Who would like to read?
which section are we on?
We're on four.
We're on section three. No,
oh, we're on
three.
We didn't read three? Oh, okay, sorry.
We're
on three, Mark.
Unrevealed angels?
We may have
yeah.
read it, but it's
wouldn't hurt to reprise it if
we
did.
Yeah.
So why doesn't somebody read both three and go on with four then, and then we can discuss.
Okay. Do you want me to read?
Sure.
Okay. The unrevealed angels. Numerous orders of spirit beings function throughout the domains of the local universe that are unrevealed to mortals because they are in no manner connected with the evolutionary plan of paradise ascension. In this paper, the word angel is purposely limited to the designation of those seraphic and associated offspring of the universe mother spirit who are so largely concerned with the operation of the plans of mortal survival. There serve in the local universe six other orders of related beings, the unrevealed angels, who are not in any specific manner connected with those universe activities pertaining to the paradise ascent of evolutionary mortals. These six groups of angelic associates are never called seraphim. Neither are they referred to as ministering spirits. These personalities are wholly occupied with the administrative and other affairs of Nebadon, engagements which are in no way related to man's progressive career of spiritual ascent, perfection attainment.
Mm-hmm.
Section 4, the Seraphic Worlds. The ninth group of seven primary spheres in the Salvington Circuit are the worlds of the Seraphim. Each of these worlds has six tributary satellites, whereon are the special schools devoted to all phases of Seraphic training. While the Seraphim have access to all 49 worlds comprising this group of Salvington spheres, they exclusively occupy only the first cluster of seven. The remaining six clusters are occupied by the six orders of angelic associates unrevealed on Urantia.
Mm-hmm.
Each such group maintains headquarters on one of these six primary worlds and carries on specialized activities on the six tributary satellites. Each angelic order has free access to all the worlds of these seven diverse groups. These headquarters worlds are among the magnificent realms of Nebadon. The seraphic estates are characterized by both beauty and vastness. Here each seraphim has a real home, and home means the domicile of two seraphim. They live in pairs. Though not male and female, as are the material sons and the mortal races, seraphim are negative and positive. In the majority of assignments, it requires two angels to accomplish the task. When they are not encircuited, they can work alone. Neither do they require complements of being when stationary. Ordinarily, they retain their original complements of being, but not necessarily. Such associations are primarily necessitated by function. They are not characterized by sex emotion, though they are exceedingly personal and truly affectionate.
Mm-hmm.
Besides designated homes, seraphim also have group, company, battalion, and unit headquarters. They foregather for reunions every millennium and are all present in accordance with the time of their creation. If a seraphim bears responsibilities which forbid absence from duty, she alternates attendance with her complement, being relieved by a seraphim of another birth date. each seraphic partner is thereby present at least every other reunion.
I love that section.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, it gives some proportionality to the idea of the six other unrevealed orders of angels, the ones that have nothing to do with our local universe ascent. If each has its own cluster, it tells you that essentially all those, you know, billions and trillions, you know, I mean, you have to imagine if there were 2 billion seraphim, you know, on Urantia, or even 1 billion rather, in 1934, and however many that has expanded to now, probably not double, but whatever number it's expanded to, you multiply that by the number of inhabited spheres, and you're immediately up into quadrillions of seraphim, just that would be serving on all the inhabited worlds, and not to mention all the ones that are serving on worlds all the way up. So if there are quadrillions of angels, and each pair of seraphim have a real home, the spheres on which they inhabit have to be enormous. They have to be huge. And unless, of course, they're making seraphim very, very tiny, which I don't imagine that's true. And that then also means that there are quadrillions of each of these other major orders, maybe they should have said classes, you know, of angels, because they have their own work and their own thing, which evidently, since we go through the Melchizedek University, it will be revealed to us. It might even be revealed to us right away in the next life, these kinds of beings. But we will learn all these other kind of enterprises that are going on in the local universe that have nothing to do with our enterprise, the Mortal Ascension Scheme. It's fascinating that they tell us all about that.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, I was just going to say in that last paragraph where they talk about their reunions, you know, considering what Andre was just saying about their numbers, it gives me the sense that they're very, very convivial, very social.
Mm.
That's part of their character, part of that nature, is that they love to just get together, you know, sort of like a big rancher conference or something, where the din of conversation is deafening sometimes, you know. You just imagine all these angels getting together for a reunion and how much they must enjoy that.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't speak specifically to the purpose of these reunions. Sounds almost like I'm sure there's some serious dimensions to it, but it sounds very social. Like it's just something they do because they like to do it.
And even necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary.
Yeah.
It's necessary as well.
Right. It contributes. Sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
In the paragraph above, they're saying they are exceedingly personal and truly affectionate. So, I mean, I think that really fits with what you're saying, Chuck.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting how they make this separation of affection and being personal and affectionate. They separate that from sexual dimensions. I mean, it's
an important distinction.
It's important. Yeah, I think it's helpful to think about that even in terms of our own lives. I mean, we're highly sexual, of course, sometimes more than maybe it serves our purposes. But to be able to separate out the personal and truly affectionate part from that kind of gives us a foretaste of maybe what the next life is going to be like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also interesting, you know, when you think about the proportionalities here, how much must be going on in the universe that we're just utterly unaware of, you know, and I agree with Andre. I think we'll be learning some about those other functions higher up. My guess is they don't want to overwhelm us with too much that isn't relevant to our particular situations down here. But complexity of how the universe runs and how it's administered and how these angels must be functioning within it in so many realms that really don't have to do with our ascension is pretty fascinating. It just indicates, gives a sense of proportionality of what all is going on out there. And that it's not just happening all by itself. You know, it's
right.
Being very, very lovingly administered.
And purposefully, you know. I love this, you know, idea that they never go alone, that they always live in pairs. There's one negative and one positive. And I think, okay, so those words have connotations for us, you know, and maybe the idea of something being negative is a negative idea, you know. There's a negative connotation on that. But I wonder what you guys think about that. In its highest sense, why, you know, how would a negative being and a positive being function so beautifully? And can we, you know, learn something from that?
Well,
it seems to me like it's necessary.
They're using that in a polarity analogy. They when you are talking about that, for instance, in an electrical circuit, you're talking about the negative going to the positive, you know, with electrons because they're negatively charged. And what they're indicating is that they're talking about their energy charge, and Pam on the board is, you know, underscoring, they also say active versus passive, or in another place they say aggressive versus retiring.
Right.
And that has to do with just, you know, a difference in orientation. You know, one that is more energy giving, one more energy receiving, perhaps, but that together they both function somehow. And we'll see how that works, but we already know somehow that, you know, that men and women function differently together. And if there's no set way that you can say it absolutely happens this way all the time, but there are certain patterns that have certainly arisen in how, for instance, homes function, how families function.
Mm-hmm.
And you could draw analogies from there, which I wouldn't dare to right now.
Well, we get ourselves
too many
in trouble.
Varieties, but, yeah.
But I always think of, you know, I like the aggressive and retiring analogy. It really works for me because I think sometimes the best marriages I've seen have that, you know. One person is more of an extrovert, one is an introvert. One pulls forward, the other one holds back. And so it makes this natural dynamic, which is more balanced. It creates balance in the partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, that's a beautiful thing. And what occurs to me is on this world, some of that natural balance has become antagonistic, and it doesn't have to be. I mean, I really wish it wasn't so much, so that we could just more naturally, like Pam says, do the dance, the natural dance of energy, honoring each other's gifts. And saying, well, that's a point. You've got a point. And, well, here's another point, you know, and just sit down together in our natural, you know, with our natural inclinations, some aggressive, some retiring, and work out our problems together by listening to each other and by honoring each other's point of view. And I know, you know, we got a long way to go to get there, but we could learn, you know, I like to imagine how the angels do it, of course, with love and respect, with mutual understanding that, hey, I need you. I need you. And you need me.
Yeah. Well,
and
you know,
there's something so beautiful
about
that.
Yeah.
Go
ahead, absolutely. Trent. And I was just going to say that, in a way, that's almost reflected in the design of our organism, in a sense, you know, with handedness. You know, like if, like I'm right-handed, but it doesn't mean that my left hand has no purpose, right? So you say my right hand is my aggressive hand, but my left hand is more my retiring hand. But yet it does other things that I don't do with my right hand, right? And it takes both hands together, you know, to pick up a load or to do a lot of the things we do. But there's that interesting difference even within ourselves that in some ways may be ancestral to this. There's a paragraph in paper 84 that summarizes, I think, what you're saying, Paul, in a nice way. I could just read that quick, just to, you know, kind of supplement this conversation. Here they say that the, this is 84, part 6, section 5, or in paragraph 5, paper 84, section 6, paragraph 5. They say the differences of nature, reaction, viewpoint, and thinking between men and women, far from occasioning concern, should be regarded as highly beneficial to mankind, both individually and collectively. Many orders of universe creatures are created in dual phases of personality manifestation. Among mortals, material sons, and midsoniters, this difference is described as male and female. Among seraphim, cherubim, and Maranchi companions, it has been denominated positive or aggressive and negative or retiring. Such dual associations greatly multiply versatility and overcome inherent limitations, even as do certain triune associations in the paradise Havana system.
I love that. Thank you, Chuck. That was a great cross-reference.
Yeah, and what's implied in that, what's implied in that is the complemental nature of relationship, you know. Well, even in what we just read, I think they talked about complement of being, right? So in these angelic pairs, one is the complement of being of the other. Just like with men and women, we can be complemental in our difference. And that complemental difference is what, you know, the whole thing about super additive outcomes, you know, creates the potential for outcomes that neither could do alone, or even that two of one type or two of the other type could accomplish. It really requires the pairing of complemental, you know, that complemental synergy is what gives rise to super additive outcomes, I think.
So one thing I've noticed in... Go ahead, finish your thought, sorry.
Oh, just appreciating that, I think, is important. It's one way of overcoming what can often be more of a feeling of antagonism sometimes, where gender is concerned.
Right. Right, I've noticed in my own life that, you know, I'm an outgoing person and an extrovert. My husband, Glenn, is an introvert. And I've seen in my own relationship and in other relationships, too, someone like Glenn acts as a ground wire. he's my ground, you know. He keeps me grounded. And it's so invaluable. It's so amazing. And I fully appreciate it. I always have, you know. And that people who put themselves out there need that. They need that to maintain their sense of groundedness. And, you know, so, yeah, the negative does that too in circuitry. It grounds the positive. And it's really interesting how that works. Such a beautiful design. Why we would be antagonistic to it is what we should ponder, you know. Why would we be antagonistic to the design that keeps us balanced and well?
Well, I think the trouble is in understanding. I mean, there's a gulf there. They talk about the personality gulf between men and women. You know, we have to reach across that gulf to achieve understanding. And if you feel like you're not being understood, that can be frustrating, right?
Yeah, there you
and
go.
And I think that leads oftentimes to what could be an unnecessary feeling of antagonism or conflict. But it requires a special kind of effort to reach across that gulf to establish understanding. It's like, what is it, the fan of the book, like men and women are almost like two different species or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. True.
Yeah. So it's a challenge, yeah. But it's, you know, there's so much to be gained from it.
And I guess we can say the angels have done it for so long that they're really good at it.
Right.
Yeah. They will probably delight in showing us how it's done, right?
Right, no doubt.
Yeah. Even they have disagreements from time to time, as we learn from the book. The great, right. You know, often quoted disagreement between the angels of churches and the angels of progress.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And even with these highly personal and affectionate pairs, you know, who knows what goes on, you know.
So, yeah.
I don't know. But with a sense of humor and loving, you know, loving regards. So
I'm sure they don't bicker.
A great demonstration.
You think they don't bicker? You know, it's kind of fun when you're with an old couple that's been with each other for a long, long time, and they quit at each other.
Right.
I think that's human. I think that's very
human,
and yes, it is humorous, but it's human. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess there's a lot of humor in human. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing.
Let's see, what else do we have to pick out of this section?
Well, their abodes. Can't you? I mean, won't it be exciting to see that? To see where they live. They're beautiful. I don't know. I think of them as estates, but. Each one has a real home. Isn't that interesting? They point that out. Each seraphim has a real home. And home means the domicile of two seraphim. They live in pairs. A real home.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
And where did that go? Yeah, maybe we read this already, but they comment that on the mansion worlds, this is... part two, section two, sixth paragraph. They say, on the mansion worlds, you will begin to appreciate the seraphim. On the constellation spheres, to enjoy them. While on Salvington, they will share their places of rest and worship with you.
Mm.
We get to do sleepovers with the seraphim, it sounds like.
Mm.
Sleepovers.
On the...
Bunk bed, Pam. Seraphic bunk beds. It's like Tom Hanks. I get to be on top. Pam made that comment on the board there, so that's a bit of an inside joke about angelic.
Well, they finish that paragraph by saying, throughout the whole mirage and subsequent spirit ascent, your fraternity with the seraphim will be ideal. Your companionship will be superb.
Mm.
I love that.
Me too.
Talking about it that way.
So much to look forward to. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Imagine getting to meet somebody who has known you your whole life and knows you better than anybody, except the Father himself who lives within you. But, I mean, imagine getting to meet
knows you better than you
those
know
personalities.
Yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you know, I mean, it's like having a built-in therapist, Marvin. Well, that was caused by that time when you... that traumatized you.
Thank you.
You may not realize. What a joy to have such friends.
Well,
non-judgmental friends, too. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Non-judgmental.
Yeah, it's a good thing they're not
don't judge you.
Right.
You know, you made that comment earlier, Chuck, about, or you quoted that paragraph, and the thing that jumped out to me was the word individual, because really the whole universe is designed to put judgment in the purview of the group, wouldn't you say? Even Jesus said that we can't deny the group its right to make this judgment. The group has the right to do that, but individually, no.
Or even the responsibility.
I think that's an Yeah, right. The right and the responsibility, right. So that's, you know, I think about that mm-hmm. sometimes, that the group does mm-hmm. have to be able to decide that, and the group does have to be able to determine for its own safety and well-being what needs to be done if someone is acting outside the benefit of the group or even to do harm to the group. So it's interesting to me, a distinction. They don't judge individuals.
Well, then their comment about us is to not prejudge.
Right.
I thought that was an interesting little shift in language there.
Prejudge. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Neither should individual mortals prejudge their fellow creatures.
Right. There's another place. The book speaks so many times against prejudice in clear and uncertain terms, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, or I should say clear in certain terms. They're very certain about when they talk about it. This is not a good thing, you know, to have any kind of judgment, prejudgment about somebody based on.
Yeah, prejudgment. Yeah, prejudice.
Yeah.
Good connection there between those two words.
Yeah.
Obviously meaning versus. But on the other hand, at least in the conduct of our own affairs, we do have to make judgments. At least for our own well-being and our own safety sometimes, you know, regarding fellow creatures, fellow mortals. So that's a little different. And it's not judging in the sense of like a court of law, but judging in terms of management of our own affairs. So that's where it can get tricky sometimes.
Yeah, and that's the only reason I bring it up is because it's one of those tricky places in life that requires a lot of discernment and balance.
Right.
Yeah.
But prejudging, certainly, to just assume something about somebody you don't even know anything about them, you know.
Based on something purely superficial.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Or sometimes even what someone else has said about that person, you know. We have to be careful there, too.
Boy, you know, I do, especially. I've been identifying that in my life more and more.
Mm-hmm.
How many times that I've let someone else's comment taint my own opinion. It's interesting. That's mm-hmm. that's tricky because, you know, loyalty that's kind of the downside of it, isn't it? In my opinion, that's the downside of it. And I think that those angels that went into the rebellion, they had a false loyalty. It's false loyalty. It's not genuine loyalty. Your first loyalty, I guess, should always be the truth. And so you should be able to say when someone tells you something, huh, is that true? Maybe I should go find out for myself or think about it. Before I just take on that opinion, and that's a tough one, because people can influence you, and especially beings that you trust, that you need. You know, the angels needed Lucifer; he was like their father. How easy it would be if your beloved and trusted father said to you, that man over there, don't trust him. He's a bad man. And you know, why would you question your father who loves you and takes good care of you? You know, it's a real interesting dilemma in our existence, is that we influence each other sometimes in ways that aren't fair and they're negative. Mm-hmm. They're not healthy.
Yeah. Well, Michael, of course, is our local universe sovereign. So I think loyalty to Michael is totally appropriate.
Right. A higher loyalty.
And that's right.
Right.
And I think those who were not ensnared in the rebellion held to that higher loyalty. They didn't appreciate what Lucifer was saying about Michael.
And they were at least able to say, well, you know, he's always been good to me. And he's taken good care of me, but I don't think I'm going to believe that just offhand. I think I'll find out for myself. You know, I think that's an important trait to have as a human, especially to not just let other people decide for you. You know.
Well,
you know, what you're talking about, Paula, is actually alluded to in a different context when they go into the Urmia lectures on political sovereignty. And they talk about, loyalties. So in paper 134, section 5, paragraph 8, the difficulty in the evolution of political sovereignty, and this is with regard to political sovereignty, but they do actually relate it back to, you know, the basic unit, the family. From the family to all mankind lies in the inertia resistance exhibited on all intervening levels. Families have, on occasion, defied their clan, while clans and tribes have often been subversive to the sovereignty of the territorial state. Each new and forward evolution of political sovereignty is, and has always been, embarrassed and hampered by the scaffolding stages of the previous developments in political organization. And here's the rub. And this is true because human loyalties, once mobilized, to change. The same loyalty which makes possible the evolution of the tribe makes difficult the evolution of the super tribe, the territorial state. And the same loyalty, patriotism, which makes possible the evolution of the territorial state, vastly complicates the evolutionary development of the government of all mankind. So when you were talking about the idea of, you know, you have friends or whatever, and it's natural as part of one's friendship to want to show solidarity. And so there's a natural movement to agreement. It's conversational. It's in the language. Everything leans toward that. And when it's not a friend, when it's someone who is a stranger, quote unquote, many things lean away from moving into solidarity with somebody like that. There's a lot of circumspection. There's a lot of paying attention to that person and making decisions, first of all, do I trust them? When you have trust already, you don't naturally look at, should I trust them?
You don't doubt it.
Yeah, reassess and say, I don't know about that. You know, it's a rare individual who understands a person so well that they understand, yeah, I can trust them in this realm. I can't really trust them in that way. It takes not just wisdom. That's a little too broad brush. It takes really paying attention and actually a refined, wise sort of love to pay attention to a person to that extent that you understand where they do really well, where they better than you, and where they don't do so well. And where maybe you do a little bit better than them, and that's part of the nature of your friendship is, you know, the give and take that you have in that kind of relationship without it becoming judgy. There again, difficulty. And so interesting human relationship nuances that have come out in just this consideration of the angels.
Yeah, well, thanks. It was a great discussion. I how it got there, I don't actually recall, but it's important.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we have to deal with on a planet like ours, where there's active agency of rebellion going on, is the danger of deception. That deceptions are put forward. I mean, Lucifer was the deceiver. Who was it they referred to? Lucifer, deceiver of the worlds or something like that.
And the Archdeceiver too.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Caligasti is right in the same on the same team. So
right. We
gotta, like you're saying, we have to have a lot of discernment when we look at things to make sure we're not being deceived, even by an idea or a characterization of someone that might seem very tempting or might seem like, oh, yeah, that's I'm going to go with that. You know, it
or
may
compelling,
not be true.
Very compelling.
Yeah, compelling, right. Yeah.
I mean, nobody, apparently, nobody wants to be made a fool of. You know, I mean, it's interesting to me. It seems like one of the greatest of all human fears is to believe something in error or believe, you know, to think that somebody fooled you and made a fool of you, made you look foolish.
Yeah. Fear of ridicule. Fear of ridicule. Yeah.
Or even the fear of knowing, of having to say, wow, I really got taken down the primrose path there, which goes to another quote, Andre, it speaks of once having started off down the wrong path, it's very, very hard to admit and turn around and come back, you know. And even for angels, obviously, I mean, you know, that's something that shows me that they are very close to us. They're susceptible to some of the same sophistries that we are.
Yeah, apparently.
And even as brilliant as they are and as experienced as they are, they can fall prey to some of the same sophistries that we fall prey to. It's sobering, you know?
Well, I think it goes back to what you were talking about earlier at the beginning of the show, Andre, is that I think part of what antidotes all of those limitations is the long, long experience and the gathering of experiential wisdom that these angels have. And that's part of the perspective that they offer us, you know, is they've seen it all over such long periods of time that they've really garnered tremendous wisdom and can help us by offering those perspectives as we struggle along. I think that's part of what they offer.
Yeah, particularly the ones who've been rebellion tested.
Well,
maybe
you know,
we could go on. Oh.
Yeah, let's do. I just want to say one more thought in about the Archdeceiver. not like he's my favorite topic or anything, but I do think about the rebellion, and I don't think any Urantia book reader doesn't think about it, you know, because it's clearly one of the main concepts of the book. Certainly not unique to the Urantia book; it was said in the Bible and other scriptures as well. But it clearly, you know, the Urantia book brings home how much it has affected our world in so many ways. And but I think about, when I think about him, I don't, and any of the rebellious spirits, I think they believe what they're saying. I don't think that they know they're lying. Do you think they know they're lying?
They became insincere. They became insincere. And that was the big shift.
Yeah,
from which they could not return.
They also use the term self-deceived. They also, self-deceived, which is a very interesting term.
Self-deceived, right.
Yeah, that they've sort of, and they say this about Lucifer, you know, I think what you were referring to earlier, Paula, about turn back is, at some point they say he realized that he might be mistaken, but he was so far along that path that he decided to throw that realization away, put it aside, and work to continue to self-deceive himself and embrace more and more fully his error, and it became...
So in that regard, he truly is a liar. Do you think that he knows now the existence of the Heavenly Father and would admit that the Father exists, except that he's gone so far down his path of deception that he couldn't possibly admit that?
It's hard to put ourselves in that place, I think, because they do describe it as a form of cosmic insanity. You know,
maybe that's what it is.
Derangement. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a state that's so far away from where we are in many mm-hmm. respects. It's hard for us to get our arms around it.
Yeah.
Diane on the board said it's interesting that the Sanhedrin called Jesus the deceiver. That is an interesting, you know, distinction when the deceivers call the other person the truth of deception.
Well, that's a characteristic of rebellion, is to accuse your enemies of what you're actually doing yourself. I mean, it started off with Lucifer accusing Michael of usurping authority by coming up with this myth of the Universal Father, when it was actually Lucifer who was attempting to
that
usurp
was doing
authority.
That.
Yeah, good so you
point.
See that pattern even in the world mm-hmm. today. I mean, you know, that those who accuse others of something are very oftentimes the ones who are doing it themselves. So we have to keep an eye on that, because that's a signature of rebellion, and we see that happening.
It's a tell, in a way.
Yeah, kind of a tell. Yeah, like in a card game or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you have to have a lot of discernment to see that and not be pulled in by it.
Even Shakespeare said, methinks he doth protest too much.
right, exactly.
But go ahead, Chuck.
Or Marachimota 28, too, is sort of about the same
thing.
Right, in this paragraph in Lucifer Rebellion, paper 58, section 2, paragraph 5, they talk about also the factor of pride.
53.
To this. 53.25, yeah. That'll just pick up a couple
lines
in the middle
of
this paragraph. They say by the time his plans had developed, they say, well, let me back up a little bit. There must have been a pride of self that nourished itself to the point of self-deception, so that Lucifer for a time really persuaded himself that his contemplation of rebellion was actually for the good of the system, if not of the universe. By the time his plans had developed to the point of disillusionment, no doubt he had gone too far for his original and mischief-making pride to permit him to stop. At some point in this experience, he became insincere, and evil evolved into deliberate and willful sin.
Mm. Insincere, okay. That's the meaning of that. He knew his manifesto was a lie.
Yeah.
Well, even if he didn't, I mean, you can look at people and you can ask yourself, does everybody get to the point of actually denying the existence of God if they are doing that? Or do they, because they never exercise faith, do they simply never allow themselves the opportunity to let that reality in? It's a subtle distinction, but there are two different ways of allowing that, and in that case, what is the actual case? Did Lucifer ever truly believe in the Father? He may have at some point. Did he, in denying the existence of the Father, decide that he was deluded in the first place? Or he just never really get to the point. We don't understand, like Marvin alluded to. We don't understand Monadic psychology.
Yeah.
Well,
it's on a whole different level.
Understand that psychology.
Right. You look at the example of the scribes and the Pharisees, you know, who nominally were God-believing. They believed there was a God. But functionally, they had, as the book describes it, they had displaced the functioning power of that spirit nucleus in themselves by their own self-concepts, which were related to power and greed and so functionally, they rejected God, even though they nominally, you know, accepted God. And Jesus called them whited sepulchres. I mean, he had some very uncompromising terms. And they were, you could say they were Luciferian, you know. They were functionally just working out that philosophy, even though they religiously, they were sophisticated and believed in God. So I think you're right, Andre. It takes numerous forms, including some that are religious. You know, some of the most
whatever vehicle works, right? It's a means to an end.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jesus was pretty clear with his apostles, too, when he said, you know, the heathen rage because they know not the truth. But why do you languish in futile learning? Because you obey not the truth. You know, you know it, but you don't obey it. And that's prevalent, too, sometimes in this world.
Yeah.
You know a higher truth, but you're not constrained to obey it or follow it, you know?
Mm. There's an interesting comment by the Melchizedek author of Paper 66, talking about Caligastia. This is 66.1.5, right at the end of that paragraph. He says, I did not then comprehend that Caligastia was insidiously falling in love with himself.
Mm.
I did not then so fully understand the subtleties of personality pride. So this is one of the things about the Lonanadecs. They're so brilliant. You know, they can, this can happen to them where they just look at themselves in the mirror and say, man, I'm God all over the place, right? You know, it's like Caligastia declared himself God of Urantia. You know, they have this hubris that follows from, that can follow from their brilliance and lead them, you know, astray in this particular way. You know, that's so interesting, I think, how he says that. I did not then comprehend that Caligastia was insidiously falling in love with himself. So once you do that, you know, father, smother, you know, it's like, what difference does it make? You know, I'm in charge here, you know. Right, something like that. I don't know. Mm. That yielding that self-restraint, that quality of self-restraint where you look to a higher source of guidance just flees from their thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then they become completely untethered as a result. You know, it's like, do what thou wilt, you know.
Yeah, I think we see that on this world a lot.
Oh, totally, you know? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Look at current events.
Yeah, we're even encouraged to fall in love with ourselves. I mean, how often do you hear that, you know?
Yeah. So,
I mean, it's,
well,
it's one thing to have good regard for yourself, but not it shouldn't so supersede our love for the Creator. Yeah.
Right, to keep a wholesome perspective about who we are.
Exactly.
I love that quote that says, you know, intellect, while the source of intellect or the source of mind may be divine, surely on your planet it's not. And contemplation of the immature human intellect should lead only to reactions of humility. I mean, they couldn't be more clear there. You know, you're little in the universe. Get over your bad self. Kind of snap out of it. It's one of their snap out of it moments, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so shall we go on and read about seraphic training, you guys, since we're, you know, we've got
section 5.
Marvin, you want to read that, Marvin?
Yeah, sure. Section 5, paper 38, seraphic training. And I think worth remembering that the seraphim are the ones that are involved in our ascension scheme. When they use that term, they use the term angels for all other orders, but they don't only use seraphim for those involved in our ascension process. Seraphim spend their first millennium as non-commissioned observers on Salvington and its associated world schools. The second millennium is spent on the seraphic worlds of the Salvington circuit. Their central training school is now presided over by the first 100,000 Nebadon seraphim, and at their head is the original or firstborn angel of this local universe. The first created group of Nebadon seraphim were trained by a corps of 1,000 seraphim from Avalon. Subsequently, our angels have been taught by their own seniors. The Melchizedeks also have a large part in the education and training of all local universe angels, seraphim, cherubim, and sanabim. At the termination of this period of training on the seraphic worlds of Salvington, seraphim are mobilized in the conventional groups and units of the angelic organization and are assigned to some one of the constellations. They are not yet commissioned as ministering spirits, although they have well entered upon the pre-commissioned phases of angelic training. Seraphim are initiated as ministering spirits by serving as observers on the lowest of the evolutionary worlds. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So they observe for a while at the very lowest realms. After this experience, they return to the associate worlds of the headquarters of the assigned constellation to begin their advanced studies and more definitely to prepare for service in some particular local system. Following this general education, they are advanced to the service of some one of the local systems. On the architectural worlds associated with the capital of some Nebadon system, our seraphim complete their training and are commissioned as ministering spirits of time. When once seraphim are commissioned, they range all Nebadon, even Orvanton, on assignment. Their work in the universe is without bounds and limitations. They are closely associated with the material creatures of the worlds and are ever in the service of the lower orders of spiritual personalities, making contact between these beings of the spirit world and the mortals of the material realms.
Hmm. 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 I have a question. When they're talking about the seraphim, are they talking about... They in the unrevealed angels, they mentioned six other groups. So is that, should we understand that there are seven, including the ministering spirits, which are the ones that deal with us, and then the six others, are they talking about all of those groups?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
No. The ministering spirits, the ones that are observing as ministering spirits, those are the only ones. We could regard it, I mean, one way to understand this is to make the comparison that these are the ones that serve those that are going to Ascendington, okay, that are going to call Ascendington their home. So these are seraphim. These angels, a larger category, are seraphim. The six others we might look at as, maybe they have something to do with serving those beings that have something to do with the Father. Those that are having something to do with a purpose of the Son, and so on through those six, right? We know that ascenders are of the nature of having the Father, Son, and Spirit, you know, by virtue of, you know, being indwelt by thought adjusters and all of that. So when you look at these other six, that's probably something about how they are tasked, though they don't reveal anything about the nature of who it is they're serving and how they are tasked in that regard. Although I've often speculated that the sixth group are angels of the angels in a certain sense, that they may serve all seven angelic corps in some regard that we can't fully fathom. You know, angels need servants too, probably in some regard, though we don't know what that would be necessarily. Anyway.
Yeah, the cherubim.
I digress.
At least
no, it's
interesting. Cherubim and cherubim are definitely in the ministering spirit line. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's quite a supporting cast when you think it's, six to one, or six times more of these other administrative beings are needed.
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it?
One-seventh. Yeah, they're just
one-seventh. Right.
Yeah.
And the rest is administrative. And, you know, what it made me think of is I saw a speech by an outgoing politician recently, and he was thanking all of his staff. And I thought, wow, does every congressperson have a staff like that? Well, they all do. And so those are all of the little minions working behind the scenes to make it possible
right.
for that one person to do what they do. Whether, you know,
yeah.
whether you find it of value or not, I guess, is irrelevant to the fact that they need this entire staff in order to empower them to do what they're doing. It just really struck me, you know, how many administrators are working behind the scenes, even on this human level, to empower somebody to do something. And I guess that's true when you
yeah.
look at almost any profession. You look at a minister. How many church staff are behind him, helping him make his sermon, you know, and his worship every week? How many, you know, how many people are behind the scenes for one actor, making them look good, you know, setting up the scene
mm-hmm.
and the props and all of that and the cameras and their skill all lends to that, making that one person, the point person, be able to do a decent job, you know, or
mm-hmm.
you know, it's interesting. Yeah. It makes sense, I guess, that many
yeah.
administrators
yeah.
are required to make it work.
It's sort of along those lines. There's an interesting detail here, I think, in the first paragraph where they talk about the first group of created seraphim were trained by a corps of 1,000 seraphim from Avalon. And that kind of
yeah.
piqued my interest because there are few mentions of Avalon in the book. And it seems like our
right.
Our universe has a kind of a special relationship with Avalon. And it's a
mm-hmm.
super universe. Right. They say in paper 32, they list the neighboring universes, Avalon, Hensalon, Sensalon, Portalon, Wolverine, Fanaving and Alvering. But the if you all recall, I'm sure you do, with the corporeal staff, that it was a team of Avalon surgeons who
right.
handled the responsibility of transferring the life plasma from the endonic contributors into the corporeal staff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one mention, and then there's the one we just read. And there's
yes.
another one here where they mention that when the planet went into receivership, this is in 6765, where they say that the affairs of Urantia were for a long time administered by a council of planetary receivers, 12 Melchizedeks, confirmed by the mandate of the senior constellation ruler, the Most High Father of Nerlashadech. Then they go on to say, associated with the Melchizedek receivers was an advisory council consisting of one of the loyal aides of the fallen prince, two resident life carriers, a trinitized son in apprenticeship training, if you can imagine, a volunteer teacher son, a brilliant evening star of Avalon, periodically, the chiefs of seraphim and cherubim, advisors from two neighboring planets, the director general of subordinate angelic life, and Van, the commander-in-chief of the Midway creatures. So buried in the middle of that long list is a brilliant evening star of Avalon. I don't know. I just think that's interesting. These are three different,
it
very
is,
specific. Actually.
There
yeah.
are big
yeah.
brothers
why,
in the universe.
Why
is that? Is, are they right
yeah.
ahead of us? That's what I get from it. They're right ahead of us in the ladder of ascension. And so
or
they're
they
reaching
may be
back
the nearest. Or Avalon
yeah.
may be the nearest.
Good point. Maybe the nearest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be just pure logistics.
Well, or
yeah.
it mm-hmm. seems like there is a special relationship there on some basis.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
A big brotherly kind of relationship, for sure. But why wouldn't it be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Andre,
but just to finish
oh, yeah.
what
well,
we just read, though, what we just read suggests that they're farther along in the
yeah,
sense.
Right.
That
yeah,
have,
right. It would have to be in order for us to be relying on them. Yeah.
For their
right.
angels
absolutely.
To train our angels, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Whereas you wonder about Hensalon, since they, you know, did they come after? Although they've had more more, they've lost more Lunan index, so maybe they came before and they just, that creator sun just has given more leeway to his Lunan index, even more leeway than Michael has given to his. So it's hard to know what all of those things
Nothing
mean.
Nothing definitive.
But there is one interesting nuance that I have often speculated about just to myself. I haven't really talked to, other readers about this, but it's always interesting to wonder about the linguistics. And you wonder in the naming of the local universes, what is determining, some of the naming of that? And we know that Michael of Nevadon, the one thing they say about him is that he more definitely is representative of the Eternal Son. He more resembles, that is, the Eternal Son rather than the Father. And I have often wondered whether Hensalon, Avalon, Portalon, and Sansalon, are more mother-like, eternal son-like, creator sons, and Alvaring, Fanoving, and what's the other one there? I'm not looking at it, but Wolverine, are more father-like creator sons, perhaps. And that's where the ing comes from. And that would be an insight into the language. It's entirely speculative. But you wonder what's the difference. It's a clear linguistic difference in those names. And it's the only example they give us in those closest local universes to us. So we have eight examples, and that's what we see. Is some end with on and some end with ing. What does that tell us?
Interesting.
There might be something to that. Well, there's an too. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I was just going to say it's interesting too. Of all those names, Avalon is the one that we're already familiar with. It comes up in the Arthurian legends. I was just looking here
it
on
does.
Wikipedia. They describe it as the mythical island featured in the Arthurian legend that first appeared in Geoffrey of Monmouth's influential 1136 writings as a place of magic where King Arthur's sword Excalibur was made, and later where Arthur was taken to recover from being gravely wounded in the Battle of Camlann. Anyway.
Wow.
Since then, the island is a symbol of Arthurian mythology. So, interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the etymology was interesting, too. I was looking at that last week. It's coming from Latin and then Welsh and Cornish. Literally, the Isle of Fruit. Or the Isle of Fruit Trees or Apple Trees. So that's interesting, Why pick that one? And it's clear by that there is some translation going on. And in translating this into English, they are using some English etymology that, maybe this is slightly different in the language of Nevadon, but they're translating it to us as Avalon, which then begs, what do you find out if you look at Portalon, or you look at, Wolverine, or Fanoving, or any of that? And it's highly elusive. It's really, for those, shall I say, nerdy types, whoever they are, go look into that.
I guess
stuff.
That's me. I find it fascinating, actually, and I find it fascinating that there's meaning in those terms, that we can glean meaning from even that, it's talk about so much meaning to be had,
right?
Even from looking at why they termed things the way they did. We might think they're coined, but there's purpose there. There's meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm wondering, sorry.
You wonder if something like Portal On, you know, that one seems to have an easier correspondence if it's dealing with door or portal of some kind. The land of the portal, sort of like, you know, St. Louis is the gateway to the West. Is Portal On somehow, you know, the doorway local universe somehow in some reference? Who knows? You know, I mean, you can speculate about a lot of that stuff.
A higher aggregation, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, Chris Halverson's done a lot of speculation. And it's always interesting to hear some of his ideas on this, but they're not giving us something that isn't nuanced, that doesn't have, you know, something to convey to us if we do some study. And it may not be that everything corresponds exactly to English. Some people think that it must always, but
not necessarily.
When I think about the one reference, the thing that has, you know, expanded my view in terms of how you might go into scholarship with some of these things is when they give us the reference of Jesus, now going to the Jesus papers, and he, I believe, talks to the apostles. They go over the first bridge they ever went through in either Caesarea Philippi or somewhere up there. And he says, this world is only a bridge. Do not seek to build a dwelling on it. There is actually, in Arabic, somewhere in the Middle East, not even in the Middle East, further east than the Middle East, a bridge that has, in Arabic, that exact phrase inscribed on it. This world is only a bridge. Do not seek to put a dwelling on it. Now that is remarkable.
Yeah, that is.
And what it suggests to me is that there may be things that we discover that do not come from the English language that are layered into the Urantia teachings at some point. That has largely not been explored.
Yeah. I wonder if you guys can clear up something.
There's a question on the board, and I just want to be able to, because I think you guys can answer it pretty easily, and it's one I missed, and I'm sorry, Gina. Gina asked this question a little bit ago about the angels. She said, so are there angels here today who still subscribe to the Lucifer Manifesto? And I thought, you know, you could easily answer that one, so...
No,
I think
all been interned. I mean, I think the only illusion as of, you know, the quote present tense when the revelation was written was that Caligastia, if I remember correctly, was the only one still free on our world back then, which was 100 years ago. And they looked for him to be interned with the others. I think there's some connection to the adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion, although, I don't remember what they say about whether he was going to be. They say he was very curtailed, and only those who really desire to be cursed with his presence and influenced by his presence are subject to any influence by him. So I think an awful lot of what gets accorded to the devil is really kind of outmoded. I think really the people who are devil worshippers who have really embraced the Luciferian values wholeheartedly and which are ruthless and self-centered and assume no higher presence, those people might be influenced, but those are matters of judgment way beyond our level, I think.
But I don't think any angels
are running around that have embraced the Lucifer Manifesto. But I think they're still all interned.
No, Caligastia and Daligastia.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go, Gina. We all agree. Nope, they're not. They're gone.
There is language. There is language to that effect.
Yes, there is. It's pretty cool, pretty definitive. Mm-hmm.
If I could just interject one last time here on this thing about Avalon, I think I may have misspoke. I believe it's a little ambiguous from that one passage in the book, but I think those Avalon, Hensalon, et cetera, are neighboring local universes, not super universes. Am I correct in that? Or do you have anything definitive on that? That these neighboring universes they refer to in 32-212, those are neighboring local universes, not super universes.
Right.
They would have to be. Right. Okay. I misspoke on that previous word, so I want to clear that up.
Okay.
Okay. Well, and since it might be a good time to mention to everyone, and by the way, Gina said if you guys could give her that definitive language, she'd really appreciate it. So if one you great quote finders could find where it says they've all been interned except for Dalagastia and Caligastia, that would be great. And I just want to mention that we won't be here next week, friends, because we're going to take Christmas Eve off, and we'll be back for New Year's Eve. But I want to wish everybody, and I know all my friends here on the phone with me would love to wish you all a wonderful Merry Christmas and a beautiful holiday season with the people you love nearby, and much joy in your lives throughout the holiday season. And, thank you for being such loyal listeners. We always love seeing you on the board. It's such a delight. And someone mentioned that maybe we should go from this paper to the Guardian Angel paper next. So I'm up for that, too. Also, it was mentioned to us recently, friends, that we cover the first five papers of the book on God. I think Gina mentioned that, and nothing would please me more than that, too. So we can either go from here to the angel paper or the guardian angel paper, Seraphic Guardians of Destiny, or we can go to the first paper of the book, the Universal Father. So that's a lot of good things coming up.
It'll probably be right in the new year sometime. We can make a decision as to how that goes. We'll definitely be finishing up this paper or doing the rest of it in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We can make a determination. If you have any opinions, by all means, you can email any one of us or weigh in and just let us know. Yeah, is there an email address that our listeners should send any kind of opinions as to what they would like to see as the next study? We're taking into serious account. We were very much leaning toward the idea of the first five papers, and I think we're going to do that. But how much of the angel we put in between that, we still haven't quite decided yet. So let us know, and we'll take that all under advisement.
All right.
Yeah, and if you want to visit our page on the fellowship's website, the Urantia Book Fellowship, our sponsor, yay! One of the wonderful things that the fellowship has done for so long is outreach. So basic, and they have put up a wonderful page for us on their main site, and you can find it under our programs. And I believe there is somewhere where you can reach out to us and tell us what you'd like to see us do. You can contact us from there if you go to under our programs and you click on the Cosmic Citizen. You'll be able to send us your ideas. And the fellowship's website is www.urantiabook.org. So please do reach out to us and let us know what you'd like to see us do. We appreciate it.
I found those references.
Oh, you did? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Do you want to give them and we'll put them in the chat real quick? We got about 4 minutes.
Okay, so there may be others, but there's two in paper 77. So in 77-78, they say that the entire group of rebel midwayers is at present held prisoner by order of the Most High's Videntia. And then in 77-74, I don't have it, the first part of the sentence, but they say the rebel cherubim and seraphim who were also on earth up to the time of Christ's death and resurrection.
Up to that time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When Jesus left, they left too. That was it for them. They were out of here.
Yeah.
Good.
But
thank
both
you.
Both of those
appreciate that.
Raise all kinds of interesting questions about how that was done, how they were rounded up and removed. I mean, you can only imagine, but.
I imagine it was pretty
shocking
for them.
I assume they weren't cooperative with that. Anyway.
Yeah. And by the way, to Andre's point, you can reach out to us directly at cosmiccitizen@yourranchobook.org. And I put that in the chat as well. So if you have suggestions or ideas, cosmiccitizen@yourranchobook.org.
Does that go to
thanks,
you, Paula?
Who
does that go to?
I don't honestly know, but I think Jeff would know.
Well, we should find out.
Or Lester's director. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Gina knows.
I'll find out who that goes to and see if we can get that.
Thank you, Andre.
That's routing somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's not going into the ethers. We don't want that. The fact that I had to go look it up tells you something, my friends, but.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, just once again want to say thank you to all of you. We had a great board today. What a lively discussion on the board we had with Gina and John Shiner and Pam and Diane and Bob and Perry.
Isadora.
And also someone, and Isadora, Isadora, of course. Our dear, dear friends. And John and Vaughn are listening by on the phone. And to all of our listeners in the archive, thank you. It's a delight. It's a delight to meet you at conferences. We're always amazed, and I think surprised, you know, when you come up and say, "Yeah, I've been listening to you guys." But of course, we're glad, and that's why we do it, and we really appreciate it. And we'll be back to cap off the year on New Year's Eve, most likely. We'll let you know if not. But
New Year's Eve Day,
New Year's Eve Day.
Okay.
Right. So, anyway,
all right.
Merry Christmas, friends.
Yeah,
what a
Merry
nice
Christmas.
Show.
Merry Christmas and
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah,
Right.
First day of Hanukkah tonight.
Merry Mithras.
Merry Mithras.
Merry Mithras coming up,
It's okay.
Anyway.
It's okay. It doesn't matter where we get our holidays from.
Right.
As Diane loves to say, this is Christmas, the Mass of Christ believers, which that always stays with me, dear Diane. Thank you for that. The Mass of Christ believers.
Indeed.
So, well, we got done on time today, you guys. How nice.
Yes, we did.
Yeah.
All right. All the best, everyone.
Yeah.
Until 2 weeks from now. Bye for now.
Until 2 weeks. Bye for
now. Yeah. Enjoy the season.
Enjoy the holidays.
Yeah. That's great.
Love
holidays.
You.
Mm-hmm. Love you.
Love you so much.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, Only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.